people in this town a guaranteed basic income. It was the equivalent of $15,000 a year. They said to them, we're just going to give you this money in monthly installments. There's nothing you have to do in return for it, and there's nothing you can do that means we'll take it away. And they followed what happened over the next 3 years. The most powerful thing for me is there was a massive fall in depression and anxiety. Depression and anxiety that were so severe people had to be hospitalized fell by 9%. Now, that tells us something. It tells us the financial insecurity of neoliberalism that you guys document so brilliantly is causing a lot of that depression and anxiety. Firstly, it's very empowering to people to tell them, your depression is caused by these factors in the way we're living. It's not that you're just your brain is broken. There are factors in your brain going on, of course. We're biological beings, but that's not the primary driver here. And there are solutions that we can band together and fight for. That's much more destigmatizing and empowering. And it's not a kind of straw man about saying the drugs are bad.
Johan, earlier this month, British Prime Minister Theresa May appointed a minister for loneliness following a year-long investigation which found 14% of the population in the UK often or always feels lonely. Can you talk about the connection between loneliness and depression? And you have 20 seconds.
Yeah, we are the loneliest society there's ever been. Professor John Cacioppo at Chicago University has shown that. There are doctors that have started prescribing lonely people to take part in voluntary gardening groups. That is twice as effective as chemical antidepressants in reducing depression. We've got to look at the wider solutions. The book goes through the 9 causes of depression and anxiety for which there is scientific evidence and 7 different kinds of antidepressant that we should be utilizing alongside chemical antidepressants.
We're going to do part 2 of this discussion. We'll post it online at democracynow.org. Johan Hari's new book is out. It is called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a full-time news fellow. Submit your application by February 5th to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The time is 5:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church in Portland. The Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival features 7 new music performers, performing works by living composers, both well-known and lesser-known, as well as some works by recently deceased 20th century composers. Music by Lou Harrison, Jacob Druckmann, Julia Wolf, David Lang, and many, many more. Again, that's the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 Years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own words. We have an online tour, which features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an accidental shooting at a training facility in Clatsop County left one soldier dead.
Burgerville workers continue to fight for fair pay and better working conditions.
And today marks the beginning of Black History Month.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 1st, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. The Clatsop County Sheriff's Office is investigating what has been reported as an accidental shooting that occurred Wednesday at approximately 6:30 p.m. at Camp Rylea. Members of a regular U.S. Army unit conducting training at Camp Rylea reported a gunshot in the housing area. Doctors at the emergency room at Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria declared the soldier dead on arrival. The soldier's identity is being withheld pending notification of next of kin. The Army's Special Operations Command refused to comment, stating that the incident is, quote, under investigation, end quote. Camp Rylea is the primary training facility for the Oregon National Guard.
Today, Burgerville workers at the convention center store went on strike, once again demanding the fast food company negotiate with the Burgerville Workers Union, or the BVWU. Those on strike were joined with other community organizations who have been rallying for the BVWU since April 2016, such as the Community Alliance of Tenants, Jobs with Justice, CEIU, and United Brotherhood of Carpenters. BVWU's achievements so far have been acquiring a 50-cent raise, a union benefits program, and the adoption of a less taxing closing shift. Despite these successes, Burgerville has fired workers and allowed security guards to cause picketers and protesters physical harm. BVWU has filed over 30 unfair labor practice violations against Burgerville with the National Labor Relations Board. This winter, Burgerville workers at the Gladstone and Hawthorne stores joined the movement. Organizers from the union campaign said that the unionizing part of a larger fast food movement in the U.S., citing the nationwide demonstration by food workers to walk off their jobs on Labor Day last year, and the United Kingdom's recent decision to raise pay for its McDonald's and fast food workers. The Burgerville strike will continue at the convention center until 10 p.m. tonight and will reconvene on Friday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park in Portland.
A Portland Police Oversight Board got a couple of new members yesterday. KBOO reporter Jasmine Moneymaker has more.
The Citizen Review Committee gained two new members yesterday, despite community concerns over lack of diversity and potential bias. The Citizen Review Committee hears appeals on police accountability cases submitted to the Independent Police Review. The 11-member board is made up of volunteers who, upon approval by the City Council, serve three-year terms. The newest members are Albert Lee and Vadim Mazursky, who were both appointed unanimously during the PM session of City Council on Wednesday. Albert Lee, a dean at Portland Community College, wrote in his application for the CRC position about a lifelong friendship with a St. Louis police officer, a revelation that raised concerns for Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch.
We are concerned about the comment made by Mr. Lee in his application about his lifelong friend in the St. Louis Police Department. I'll quote from the application. On special assignments, including Ferguson and riot control, after difficult judicial decisions, as a black officer, he has faced ire and discontent from some parts of the black community. He is an excellent officer and one that I'm trying to personally recruit to Portland. So this statement appears to indicate that Mr. Lee doesn't understand why community members might be upset with an officer of color who participates in violent crackdowns against protests, which are dubbed riots by those in charge, when only a few people are causing property damage or other potentially criminal acts. That he wants to recruit his friend to the Portland Police indicates he may have a hidden bias in favor of the police point of view, which would make him not the kind of neutral candidate we want from the CRC.
Handelman urged the City Council to delay Lee's appointment until later in the month. The second appointee, Vadim Mazursky, is an administrative law judge with the Social Security Administration. Mazursky will join several other attorneys on the CRC board. All CRC members have at least a bachelor's degree, and all are established professionals. Regina Hanlon, also of Portland Cop Watch, pointed out that the board's socioeconomic makeup is not representative of Portlanders who most frequently come into contact with police.
I am concerned that the CRC is not truly representative of our whole community. It is made up mainly of professionals, and I am particularly concerned about the houseless community. In my many contacts with that community, I have found they are particularly treated poorly by the Portland police. They are subject to sweeps, they have their belongings confiscated, and they are frequently stopped and asked to produce their ID. Yet, There is no one from that community or from any agency that assists them that are members of the CRC. And I believe this is an issue that needs to be addressed and worked on.
Lee and Mazursky are replacing Julie Ramos and Fiasha Ford, two African-American women who decided not to continue with the CRC for undisclosed reasons. In addition to the two new members, current chair Kristen Malone and member Julie Falk were reappointed to a second three-year term. This is Jasmine Moneymaker with KBOO News.
The Secretary of State's blistering audit of the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Welfare Division targeted each component of the floundering agency responsible for the safety of neglected and abused children, including receiving complaint calls, filing intake, certifying foster homes, and investigating families. The audit revealed over a decade of legislative changes that were designed to help some of Oregon's most fragile children. It discovered in the Office of Child Welfare that inside the state's large Department of Human Services, the department failed to keep up with legal mandates and the increased demand for state intervention. Concurrently, the Office of Child Welfare has bore scandals like the 2015 case of Give Us This Day Foster Home in Portland, which was running substandard facilities and using improper force against foster children. Give Us This Day Executive Director Mary Holden Ayala was indicted on federal money laundering charges. On top of these alarming incidents, the audit found $39 million in legal settlements going back to 2006 over the state's shoddy protection of neglected and abused kids. The audit showed problems beginning at the top with management being disorganized, inconsistent, and a high risk for children, and pointed to the agency's tendency to continually rebrand rather than make substantive changes in order to improve services. The audit also underlined four initiatives that never delivered promised improvements. A 2006 Oregon safety model to install best practices for managing child safety was apparently disregarded. The differential response initiative aimed at helping caseworkers allow more children to stay with biological parents was stalled by turnovers in management. Two other initiatives were directed at updating the computer system to improve critical data collection, with a $20 million upgrade and a decided effort to complete more child abuse investigations. The audit found that caseworkers still report lost data, inconsistent or inaccurate search results, and inaccurately displayed information. Caseworkers continue to use sticky notes instead of the new software. A program aimed at increasing the number of complete child abuse investigation cases lasted for 3 months before ending. The Department of Human Services also fell widely below benchmarks concerning central screening centers and foster homes. In some reports, caseworkers were found to be renting hotel rooms for children to stay in or taking them home with them because of the lack of available foster families or facilities. The audit went on to say, DHS does not know the true capacity in current foster homes, what homes have openings, and what behavioral and special needs the family is trained and equipped to accept.
A sad event early this morning in Portland. A vehicle struck an unidentified pedestrian who was crossing on the east side of the intersection of Southeast 148th Avenue and Stark Street. The victim was crossing Stark Street. She had the walk signal and was within the crosswalk, according to police. The vehicle left the scene without stopping. Police have not located the driver. Anyone with information about the crash should contact the Portland Police Bureau Traffic Division 503-823-2103.
Portland Park Rangers gave notice again today to campers that they can't stay at what they call the Village of Hope, an unsanctioned homeless camp on city property off Northeast Airport Way, but campers say they do not plan to go quietly. Portland Parks and Recreation considers the site an important natural area. On Monday, Parks Commissioner Amanda Fritz said park rangers will be working to move the campers off the land. Camp organizers say their goal is to move 20 people in over the next few days. They are in the process of interviewing potential residents, Campers are vowing to stay despite pressure from the city. After giving out warnings and citations, rangers met with Village of Hope residents and their advocates for a strategy session earlier today in hopes of convincing the encampment to disband, but campers say they won't be moved. The Parks Bureau will be meeting with the mayor's office to come up with a plan. Meanwhile, the notice to vacate has to be up for at least 24 hours before the city can clear the camp. Camper and co-founder of the site, Carrie Wheeler, told KOIN that, "If I go to jail, I go to jail for the right reasons. I'm going to go to jail for my own cause." In response to concerns that the camp is located on protected land, Wheeler said, "Let us utilize it now so we don't have to go somewhere else and ruin more, probably just to survive. We're just trying to survive."
After announcing plans to continue sweeps of houseless camps and ordering the removal of protesters and advocates for the Village of Hope from Wednesday morning's city council meeting, Mayor Wheeler found time during the evening session to speak in favor of healing Portland's homeless population and declared February Black History Month in Portland.
"We celebrate the many achievements and contributions made by Black Americans to Portland's economic, cultural, spiritual, and political development. And whereas the 2018 National Black History Month theme is African Americans in Times of War, a Resilient Spirit. And whereas reflection on the Black American experience in times of war helps us to remember the significant contributions and sacrifices Black Americans made for our nation, Oregon, and Portland. And whereas in Portland, World War II is a significant marker for migration of Black families to Portland and Vanport to build and serve on ships for that war effort. And whereas, as Black veterans experienced opportunities for advancement during the war, they also witnessed repression, lack of memorialization of their contributions, and systematic withdrawal of benefits ranging from housing to health care. And whereas the housing crisis and politics of gentrification Black veterans and families faced after the Vanport floods is still very much felt in Portland. And whereas we recognize the contributions of Black community organizations, nonprofit organizations, and advocates who continue to uplift the Black community in Portland and call for racial justice and an end to economic and social inequities. Now, therefore, I, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim February 1st through 28th, 2018, to be Black History Month in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this month."
Polar bears are like... Restaurants in Hood River have come together to donate meals to the Hood River Shelter Services. According to the Hood River News, over 12 restaurants have been able to provide about $5,000 worth of meals so far. The program provides daily dinners for shelter guests as well as breakfast and snacks to take away. For businesses and the warming shelter, this has been a mutually beneficial relationship since restaurants are able to eliminate potential food waste while the shelter is able to allocate money that would otherwise go towards food costs towards other operating expenses. In addition to providing restaurant quality meals for shelter guests, the program has also provided businesses with a way of connecting with the community. The program will continue through the shelter's operating season, which goes through March 10th to 2018.
On Monday in Seattle, the King County Council voted unanimously to provide free legal representations for families of people killed by the police. As reported by the alt-weekly The Stranger, King County orders inquests when a citizen is killed by police, rare for large cities. This is not a trial or a grand jury hearing, but rather a procedure to determine the facts of the case. Nevertheless, all parties come to the inquests with lawyers. The city, the county, the state, the police department. even the individual officer who typically has union representation, everybody, that is, except the family of the deceased, who often cannot afford a lawyer. Without a lawyer, the stranger says, the ability of families to question officers and officials is very limited. And it often results of these inquests that the district attorney uses in their decision to indict the officer or not. Out of 34 inquests between 2012 and 2016, families went unrepresented in 22 of them, 65%. The King County Department of Public Defense has testified that it could handle the extra workload without added cost and will be tasked with representing the families. However, the county council has also suspended the inquest process while a county task force evaluates whether inquests are helpful at all.
From the trees and grew tall and they started talking and the stars fell out of the sky and my tears rolled into the...
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Eric DePlace about Tesoro being rejected from Washington. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be 45 degrees and rainy, followed by a tropical 50 degrees tomorrow. Today in history, in 1884, the first volume of the Oxford English Dictionary was published, the volume A through Ant. The second volume wasn't published for another year. This immense undertaking took over 30 years to complete, and at one time employed the likes of J.R.R. Tolkien, who worked on the words ranging from waggle to warlock. Soon after the first thorough dictionary was finished, it became outdated, about 3 years after it was finished, to the rapidly changing pace of the times. The Oxford English Dictionary is now only found online due to its vast volumes. The quote of the day is from birthday boy Yevgeny Zamyatin. The ancient god created the old man, capable of erring, thus he erred himself.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes in the Northwest have pledged to uphold the Paris Climate Agreement despite President Trump's backing out of it last year. Nikki Ouellette of Montana Public Radio reports.
The affiliated tribes of the Northwest Indians and eight tribal nations signed on to the We Are Still In campaign during ATNI's recent conference. We Are Still In bills itself as a network of companies, cities, states, tribes, and universities committed to tackling climate change, ensuring a clean energy future, and upholding the Paris Climate Accord, an agreement among world nations to limit the rise of the global average temperature to less than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
And we take this responsibility very seriously.
Shelley Fiant is a council member with the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in northwest Montana. She says they have been feeling the effects of a warming climate for years.
We see our glaciers melting at an accelerated rate, and we see those impacts in our forests, in our fisheries. We see it in our first foods. Our first foods are coming earlier in the season and for shorter periods of time.
The CSKT adopted a climate change strategic plan in 2013 that uses elders' experience and traditional ecological knowledge to outline goals and actions for 9 sectors impacted by climate change. Their plan predates Montana's energy blueprint by 3 years. The CSKT joins tribes from Washington, California, and Oregon supporting We Are Still In, along with 57 Northwest tribal governments represented by ATNI. For National Native News, I'm Nikki Ouellette.
Oregon's high school graduation rate has improved, yet minority students, especially Native Americans, still lag behind. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
New data shows 77% of Oregon students earn a diploma in 4 years, nearly 10 points more than the class of 2012. But with the exception of Asians, minority students all trail whites. The Native American graduation rate is lowest at 59%. Yet it's still up nearly 6 percentage points from 4 years ago.
I think we're heading in the right direction.
April Campbell is Indian Education Advisor with the State Department of Education. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde member says Native students struggle with racism, historical trauma, and poverty. But officials have taken initiative to improve attendance. Campbell says the passage of Senate Bill 13 will also help.
$2 million was set aside to develop 4th, 8th, and 10th grade American Indian curriculum. Students need to see themselves in the curriculum and in the classroom. Shifting what we've heard a lot from our family, not being seen, kind of that invisibility, to becoming visible.
Oregon's graduation rate is still below the national average of 84%. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Members of the Native American community and the group Arizona to Rally Against Native Mascots gathered at the Arizona Capitol Wednesday to discuss state lawmaker Eric Deschini's bill, which seeks to prohibit Indian mascots and logos from being displayed in publicly funded stadiums and multipurpose facilities. Under the bill, any federally recognized tribe could prohibit teams, including the Washington NFL team, from displaying images found disparaging to Native Americans. Vice President of the Navajo Nation, Jonathan Nez, was among speakers in support of the bill. According to groups involved in the national Change the Mascot movement, Indian mascots promote negative stereotypes and dehumanize Native people. Tribal and North Dakota officials worked on strengthening relationships this week during a two-day conference, which wrapped up in Bismarck Wednesday. Energy, treaties, and economic development were among topics. Leaders have been working on repairing relations after activity at Standing Rock over the Dakota Access Pipeline caused tension. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the
February 1st marks the beginning of Black History Month. Back in 1926, historian Carter G. Woodson and the Association of Negro Life and History announced the second week of February to be Negro History Week. From the start, its focus was on the teaching blacks their own history in public school. The idea was received with less than open arms by the Department of Education, including the city school administrations of Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and the states of North Carolina, Delaware, and West Virginia. Despite this chilled response, Carter Woodson continued to push for black history in schools, saying, "If a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition. It becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated." The celebrated week has since grown, and in 1969, Black History Month in February was proposed by black educators and students at Kent State University. 6 years later, Black History Month had become a nationally recognized event. The United Kingdom followed suit in 1987 and Canada in 1995. Since the event's focus centers on black education and the celebration in public institutions, many have criticized the event for limiting its scope to just 1 month, when those of African American heritage are black every day. But the celebration has only continued to grow. This year's official theme is African Americans in Times of War, marking the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I.
The Civil Liberties Minute by ACLU attorney Bill Newman highlights threats to civil liberties and what can be done to protect freedom. Today's episode looks at government spying.
Is the National Security Agency still engaging in mass warrantless spying on Americans?
My name is Ramsey Clark, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. And now the answer gets worse, because Congress has just renewed and passed a law that permits the government's warrantless spying on Americans to continue, unabated. The vote in late January concerned Section 702 of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Section 702 of FISA is the law, as disclosed by Edward Snowden, that the NSA uses to spy not on foreign intelligence operatives, but on Americans, contrary to the spirit and purpose of the law, which was due to expire. But instead of reforming the law and restricting the NSA, Congress reauthorized it. Nonetheless, there is some hope. Many Democrats and Republicans oppose Section 702, and the ACLU is challenging the provision in court. And courts in Europe may find that the U.S. government's surveillance practices violate agreements with the EU that would, as a practical matter, for business and trade reasons, require reform of Section 702. The bottom line, no one said surveillance reform was going to be easy, but the fight goes on.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
Chelsea Manning has put herself in an awkward position as she runs for Senate in Maryland. Since May of 2017, just 4 months after President Obama commuted her prison sentence for leaking sensitive military and diplomatic files on Iraq and Afghanistan, the former U.S. Army intelligence analyst has been seen attending alt-right events. In the months since regaining her freedom, Manning has traveled the U.S. speaking about the military and her time in prison with university attendees and at anti-fascist actions. But two Saturdays ago, Chelsea Manning was seen attending a gala celebrating the first anniversary of Trump's inauguration called A Night for Freedom. Photos from the event show Manning laughing with far-right Gavin McInnes, who once referred to trans people in a very, very bad way. Since then, photos dating back to November show Manning posturing with pro-Trump conspiracy pundits Lucian Wintrich and Jack Posobiec, pardon the pronunciation there, after an escape room game. In a January 22nd tweet, Manning claims her presence at the recent gala was to collect intelligence, and in a January 20th, Manning said, "I learned in prison that the best way to confront your enemies is to face them in your space." Those close to Manning told the online publication, Mike, that she is part of a large anti-fascist campaign that involves information gathering and that the operation pushed her to play along with far-righters. However, Cassandra Fairbanks, the right-wing social media maven who brought Manning to the Night of Music Freedom Gala, claims her and Manning are trusted confidants. Chelsea Manning has firmly denied the relationship. Several trans activists have expressed dismay with Manning's decision to attend the event on Twitter, saying it put Manning in a conflicting light.
You may be hearing some hype about the upcoming football game on Sunday, but you won't hear this. The movement started by Colin Kaepernick endures, but its supporters are more fragmented than ever. There have been growing divisions within the Players Coalition, a collection of NFL players committed to addressing issues of social justice. Some fans, owners, and even President Trump criticized the player protests, implying a lack of patriotism. One of the leaders of the coalition, Eagles safety Malcolm Jenkins, had discussions with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and the league's player liaison Troy Vincent. The NFL said it would pledge $89 million over 7 years to grassroots social justice groups to be matched by the players. Jenkins said the NFL's money did not preclude other players from protesting if they chose to do so, but he would no longer be demonstrating during the anthem. Other players took Reed's lead, discontinuing their participation in the demonstrations. With the season now nearly over, there's still a core group of protesters, and Kaepernick remains at the center. However, the movement overall seems to have fallen apart. One unnamed NFL owner was quoted in ESPN magazine on the cause of its demise. Quote, "The players had real leverage, but we knew we could sit back and watch them implode." End quote.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That day marked a pivotal moment in the continuing Flint sit-down strike. The nationwide strike against GM started in Flint, Michigan in late December. By late January, UAW organizers agreed that nearby Chevy engine plant number 4 had to be shut down. It was a massive facility. It employed 4,000 workers on two shifts. The plant superintendent had been firing union activists. Armed guards patrolled every inch of the facility to prevent a sit-down. Union organizers knew there were company spies in their ranks. They planned the takeover by staging distracting job actions at nearby Chevy plants number 9 and then number 6. This would draw the guards away from plant number 4. And so, on this day, just as the day's shift was ending, workers sat down at Chevy plant number 9. The company guards were ready to launch an attack. They began beating and gassing the sit-downers. The women's emergency brigade smashed plant windows to dissipate the gas. The diversion worked. Guards left Chevy number 4 unattended. Workers then turned off all the machines and barricaded themselves in. The plant guards tried to re-enter and were met with pistons, connector rods, and fire hoses. The Women's Emergency Brigade gathered outside the plant and locked arms. UAW organizer Joe Sayan announced, quote, "We want the whole world to understand what we are fighting for. We are fighting for freedom and life and liberty. This is our great opportunity. What if we should be defeated? What if we should be killed? We have only one life. That's all we can lose, and we might as well die like heroes than like slaves." For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Canada has changed its national anthem to use gender-neutral language. The lyrics of the anthem are over 100 years old, with the exception of the line, the only line that has been changed, quote, "in all thy son's command," end quote, which was added in 1913 in honor of the soldiers who fought in World War I. That line, "in all thy son's command," has now been changed to "in all of us command." There's some criticism from conservative sides stating that the vote was forced and that Canadian independence used a parliamentary procedure to change the anthem, as opposed to asking Canadians to vote on it. However, Canadian Senator Francis Lankin stated that, quote, "This may be small, it's about two words, but it's huge in terms of one of our major national symbols. It's inclusivity, and I'm proud," end quote. This has quietly come after a 30-year legal battle to make the Canadian anthem reflect all Canadians. In other Canadian inclusivity news, the Correctional Service of Canada has begun making it their policy to house prisoners in institutions with which they gender identify. Some of the policy overhauls include items such as communications products, which will reflect gender-inclusive language. Members of the Canadian penal system will use the offender's preferred name and pronoun in all communications, either written or spoken, and that individual procedures will be developed for offenders to be accommodated in the gender identity of their choice, amongst many other things. Currently, in the United States, 6 inmates are suing the state of Illinois for the right to be held in the correctional facility of their gender identity. The 6 inmates are being held at different locations and are being represented by the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. The 6 individuals are alleging inadequate care in their facilities. This class action suit is demanding immediate medical care for the female-identified inmates.
Police in Zambia have asked for the public's help in identifying 2 young women who have posted affectionate photos on social media. The images show the 2 women relaxing in a public place. In one of the photos, one woman is resting her head on the chest of the other. Zambian police, acting on the assumption that the women are violating the country's strict anti-gay laws, have launched an investigation. Police spokesperson Esther Katongo was quoted by South African outlet News 24 as saying, "We are investigating the issue of those pictures of the 2 girls which have been circulating on social media," adding that the cybercrime unit was working to identify, locate, and arrest the 2 young women. In Zambia, same-sex intimacy is punishable by up to 14 years in jail.
And now we hear from our friends at Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Georgetown and South Park sit on opposite sides of the Duwamish River on Seattle's south side. They're hubs of activity, with factories, a shipping port, train tracks, and major roadways. The area has some of the region's worst air pollution. The poor air quality contributes to a life expectancy that is more than a decade shorter than some of Seattle's other neighborhoods.
The pollution is super high.
High school student Shalina Lal wants to change that. When she was 14, she joined the Duwamish Valley Youth Corps. It's a job training program that engages teens in projects that improve their community's health and environment. She helped install rain gardens, plant trees, and build a green wall. It's a plant-covered barrier that separates industrial from residential areas. The plants help filter pollutants out of the air. Lal did not plan to be an environmentalist.
When I was growing up, I never thought I would be doing anything good. Honestly, my neighborhood's kind of scary. But my aunt grabbed me and she told me about this, and I was like, okay, I'll try it. And I did, and I absolutely loved it. Knowing that I did something like that, like helping a whole bunch of people, I couldn't ask for anything more.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
As reported in Science Daily, scientists from the German University Senckenberg Natural Research Society and the Technical University of Munich have released a study claiming that bugs are headed towards a massive die-off. It was previously thought only more specialized bugs were being immediately threatened due to a shortage in their specific habitats. The more general species were not putting anyone into immediate fear because they have a deep genetic pool that allows them to adapt much more quickly in a new environment. However, with increased human demand on their environments, they will lose such genetic diversity and thus become more specialized in their habitat, which will in turn make them more vulnerable to climate change and, of course, loss of habitat due to agriculture and human encroachment. One of the authors of the study, Dr. Jan Christensen, stated that, quote, of these animals, once these animals, due to the fragmentation of their habitats, lose the opportunity to maintain this genetic diversity by means of exchange, they will no longer be able to adapt to changing environmental conditions in the future, end quote.
The world could lose its polar bears sooner than we had thought. This according to several years of data collected by researchers at the University of Santa Cruz and the U.S. Geological Survey. Anthony Pagano and his colleagues placed tracking collars on 9 polar bears in the Beaufort Sea off Alaska. Data from the collars, along with video footage and blood samples, reveal that the bears have higher metabolisms than previously thought and need more food to maintain healthy body weights. According to Pagano, the bears need 1 adult or 3 juvenile ringed seals to sustain them. Of the 9 bears the team tracked, only 4 were able to meet that consumption mark. The others experienced dramatic weight loss of as much as 20 kilograms during a 10-day period. Pagano said he and his team, quote, were surprised to see such big changes in body masses at a time when they should be putting on bulk to sustain them during the year. This and other studies suggest that polar bears aren't able to meet their bodily demands like they once were, end quote. These revelations of polar bear fragility come amid concerns over their ability to thrive in an ever-shrinking habitat. Dr. Stephen Armstrup led polar bear research in Alaska for 30 years. He was quoted in The Guardian saying that, quote, every piece of evidence shows that polar bears are dependent on sea ice, and if we don't change the trajectory of sea ice decline, polar bears will ultimately disappear, end quote. They face the choice of coming on to land or floating off with the ice as it recedes out to the deep ocean where there is little food. We will see more bears starving and more of them on land where they will get into trouble by interacting with humans.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Grace Ann Smith, Jenna Yokoyama, Sam Bowman, and Tom Flynn. The producer is Jasmine Moneymaker. Tonight's engineer and every night's KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Flomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn cover a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, it's Pacific Underground, where we'll unpack their feels around Lunar New Year. At 10, Dale Holliday hosts Valley Views with a look at the Indivisible Movement. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on A Radio Geekly, in honor of KBOO's 50th birthday, the team chats about other geeky things that are turning 50. And at 12, join Moving On hosts Don Jacobson and Laurie Sonnenfeld for an hour of folk, political, and women's music. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Vancouver Oil Terminal would have been the world's biggest oil terminal. After meticulous auditing by the council and EFSEC staff, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee supported the council's decision to deny Tesoro access and permits to build their facilities. KBOO's Zelos Marchand spoke yesterday with Eric Duplass, Program Director for the Sightline Institute in Seattle, Washington, about the Pacific Northwest's aptly named battle for the Thin Green Line. We aired an excerpt yesterday. Next is the full interview.
Maybe you want to give our audience some backstory, although I'm fairly confident most people have been following this epic situation for the Vancouver Oil Terminal. How long has it taken to get to this point? I know there's been lots of grassroots organizing, lots of people rallying, lots of waiting.
Yeah, it's been 5 years that we've been fighting this project. And you know, it's really had this Godzilla-like effect because the project was ill-conceived and destructive from the start. It's enormous. It'd be the biggest oil-by-rail facility anywhere in North America. And, you know, what it offers in terms of benefits is virtually nothing. It's almost all downside for the Pacific Northwest. It increases the risk of explosions when the trains derail. It increases the risk of oil spills in the Columbia River. It impairs sustainable development on the Vancouver waterfront. And so, you know, at the end of the day, it's a lot of downside, not really any upside at all for the Northwest. And it's taken 5 years of protracted opposition to this project, and we finally got a really terrific result as a consequence.
That is just wonderful. So
Is it at a point now we can safely say this oil terminal is never going to be here in the Northwest? Or is there more fighting to do?
I think we can safely say that this thing is dead as a doornail. There is a technicality that allows the company 30 days to appeal the decision. But at this case, there is an exceedingly small chance that any such appeal would be successful. There is a robust evidentiary case supporting the governor's decision to deny the permit. He has all the legal authority he needs to deny this project. Even if he weren't to deny it, the Port Commission in Vancouver has declined to renew the lease for the company, so they no longer have a home as of the end of March. So there is virtually no way this project is moving forward.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly good news. Is there any chance that they would try and take up a lease in a different area in Washington or even in Oregon, say, for this project?
Yeah, a great question. I mean, it's the question of whether or not the oil barrel industry would look for other sites in the Northwest, certainly possible. The economics are deteriorating for them, so it's not likely to be as big a moneymaker as they had originally thought. And I think, too, now it's become clear that the Northwest is extremely hostile to coal, oil, and gas projects. And so, you know, when they are sitting in their corporate boardroom trying to figure out where to site their next project, I don't see how you can look at Oregon and Washington and think that's a good idea. Because the opposition movement in the Northwest has been running the tables on fossil fuel companies for the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. It's about coal, it's about oil, it's about everything else. So sure, it's possible they might go looking for another site, but boy, they're going to have tough sledding finding any place that they can get a foot in the door.
Circling back to 5 years ago, how did they get a lease in the first place?
Yeah, it happened behind closed doors, as is often the case with these things. So they had, at the time, a friendly port commission in Vancouver that probably violated some public disclosure laws that subsequently became a huge drama in Vancouver. And they were able to get an initial lease approved. They could not now do that same thing, both because the composition of the port commission has changed and also because Vancouver subsequently rezoned itself to prevent projects like this from ever coming in again. And we're seeing that all over the Northwest. And Portland actually is probably the best example of it. But one by one, a lot of these target communities have said, well, look, we can control our land use laws and our zoning laws. So what we're going to go in is we're just going to change the laws and prevent these guys from ever having an opportunity to come in and try to force one on it.
Has your company Sightline been a part of this fight from the very beginning, or did you come in sort of in the first quarter?
Yeah, we have been fighting this project since the very beginning. We have been part of a movement that we call the Thin Green Line, and the Thin Green Line to us refers to this this coastline all the way through British Columbia and Oregon and Washington. And the communities that have opposed these fossil fuel projects one after the other. And we've been really involved in that for many, many years now. We're a think tank, so the way that we do that is by supporting advocates and activists and providing them with resources and information and by undermining the companies. So we look at the financial underpinnings of these companies. We look at their safety records. We look at and pick apart their claims and their statistics and their false advertising and help make the case that these projects are a bad deal for the Northwest because they are a terrible deal and try to support the really exciting kind of growing grassroots movement that's standing up against these things.
Mm-hmm. There are, well, I was going to say rumors, but they're more than rumors of, you know, our current administration seeking to do offshore oil drilling, and on the heels of this victory for Vancouver has kind of just created a whole, like, are we next situation here in Oregon. Do you see companies like Tesoro using similar techniques in terms of trying to get their projects cemented in these states? What can we expect going forward as the Thin Green Line, as you put it? What can we expect from these companies as we defend these issues?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, yeah, up until now, over the last nearly 5 to 10 years, we have been fighting these projects pretty much at the local level. The question of offshore oil leasing is trickier because it's mostly a federal issue. States do have some jurisdiction, but it's limited. So we do have to make the most of our jurisdictional power at the state level. You know, there are also some legal strategies. Frankly, there are also some investor side attacks against companies and banks that get involved in this activity. One of the things to do is just simply to point out that it's not likely to be an economical activity. But I really see it in some ways in a positive light. Like, this is a great organizing movement. This is a moment when you take a proposal like drilling off the coast of Oregon and Washington, and almost literally everybody opposes it. So this is, and we've seen this sort of thing happen in the past, when you take an oil by rail project to Vancouver, and you sort of queue up the question for people, well, do you want an oil terminal in your backyard? And the vast majority of people across the political spectrum, across ages, you know, across class, will say, no, this is not the future we have planned for ourselves. This is not how we think we should develop. And I think it can be a crystallizing moment that grows the movement, not just for environmental issues, but for progressive issues in general. And I see the same thing with offshore oil and gas drilling. I welcome a conversation. I want that conversation to be front and center for everybody in the Northwest. Do you want oil and gas drilling on the Oregon coast, you know, in the marine sanctuary off the coast of Washington? Because the resounding answer is going to be no. And I think that actually, if we can organize around it, I think that can build power for us.
So the Thin Green Line, it's more than just a branded statement. It sounds like it's like a coalition and a grassroots movement all in one.
Well, I coined this term a few years back, and it was to refer to this idea that this region has been squeezed between huge fossil fuel reserves in the center of North America, some of the biggest reserves anywhere on Earth, and the fastest growing energy markets on the other side of the ocean. And, you know, what's happened is we've been faced with this choice. Are we going to be steamrolled and become a fossil fuel superhighway, or are we going to say no comprehensively to these projects, and in doing so, lock up a huge amount of carbon in the ground and point out for other regions that it's possible? And so, to me, it doesn't stand for any one group or organization or even affiliation, but it stands for this whole constellation of tribes and First Nations and activists and NGOs and elected officials and businesses in some cases, who have together fought back these projects one by one in every community where they've been proposed. So I think of it as a really kind of big movement that's changing the way the Northwest thinks about itself.
Why don't these companies go for the Midwest or the East Coast? Why are they coming to the
Pacific? Yeah, great question again. And the reason is about economics. It's because a lot of the cost of these products is moving them from point A to point B. So if you're taking coal out of the ground in Wyoming or gas out of the ground in Northeast British Columbia, or oil out of the Bakken Formation, and you want to sell it someplace, one of the main places you're going to want to sell it is on the Pacific Rim. And to get it there in any way that's economical, so you can actually make money, you kind of need to go through the Northwest. And it's because of rail lines and pipeline routes and everything else. But we kind of end up in this pinch point where they can't make money by taking it other places to a degree. And that means that we're going to have these fights here over and over and over again, as we have been, and we've been winning all of them. Now, the economics are in some ways getting worse for those companies, so I think we're likely to see fewer of those fights in the future. But we've got a couple of big ones still.
Big ones, including the offshore drilling proposals that we were just referencing, or what specific ones can we prepare for is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I think the offshore oil and gas drilling is obviously super, super concerning. Two big projects right now that I have my eye on, Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas project in Coos Bay. The Trump administration is trying to resuscitate that zombie of a project. They really want to get that thing approved. It's a terrible idea. So there's going to be a big fight in the Coos Bay region about that. The other one is a methanol refinery planned for Kalama, Washington, which is about an hour north of Portland. Mm-hmm. And that's a big petrochemical manufacturing site. That would send this stuff to China to make plastics, the biggest in the world, actually, if it's built. So those two projects, both relying on large quantities of fracked gas, I think those are the two big near-term fights ahead of us.
Wow. The Coos Bay LNG, and here, full disclosure, I was born on, or not born on the coast, but was raised on the coast. And the Coos Bay LNG issue goes back several years, if I'm not mistaken. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, it does. That's why I called it a zombie project. It's actually died twice before. So there's very little reason why this project should get built. In fact, there's maybe not even a market for it abroad. But the Trump administration has said clearly that they do want to try to reinvigorate it. You're absolutely right about that.
Wow. Well, so in the case of Coos Bay, can they just keep appealing? Surely there's a point where a company will say this is costing too much money and is actually getting kind of frustrating. Let's just stop. I'm just amazed still hearing about it, I guess.
They dumped a bunch of money and a bunch of time in the two previous attempts. They've had to completely redo their permit application, submit entirely new documents. They're going to go through an entirely new environmental review process. So yeah, it is costly for them. It is difficult to stop them from coming back over and over again until you do something like rezone. And Coos Bay or the Oregon Coastal Management Zone folks can proactively change land use law in a way that prevents that project from being able to get a footing, and they probably should do that at this point. So that's kind of the way that you prevent it from happening over and over again. Otherwise, yes, there's a risk of Groundhog Day.
I like the terms you're using, zombie projects and Groundhog Day, when it comes to these environmental issues. It's like it softens the blow of hard work that is required to stop these companies from squeezing the green line even further. Going back to the Calama refinery, is that project also considered a zombie project where it's been voted down, or is it relatively new?
It was very close to getting approved as of a couple of months ago, and then a state agency in Washington said that it had not properly accounted for the greenhouse gas emissions from the site. So they are getting sent back to redo their environmental impact statement. Mm. That's going to delay them by about a year. And delay is good from our perspective, because it allows more time for organizing, more time for legal strategies, and more time to screw with their finances. So not a zombie project. It's very much alive and moving forward. Mm. But I do think we can stop it.
Last year, we received news in my newsroom about the Calama